I think that the detections to APEX are fantastic, and I'm very excited to see what we can say about them. Unfortunately, I don't get to talk about those today. I'm going to talk about trying to interpret the previous M87 measurements and try to put them into a broader physical context. So this is work that Rusen Liu, who's now back at MPI, played a very important role in, and of course also a large number of other people, some of whom we'll hear later today from, and of course the HT collaboration. So I should tell my computer that I want to actually be able to control it. There we are. So we've talked a lot about M87 today being a prominent jet source, but here's my very short fact sheet. We have some mass and distance, and I've adopted what I think KN described before, roughly, but you know, just to note, there is a controversy, and I'll return to that later. Being somebody interested in imaging M87, I sincerely hope it's the larger value, but we don't really know. I just wanted to note that there are a few good reasons, which again I think have been talked about earlier today, to think that we can see the near horizon structure. Not the least of which is the fact that we have an SED for M87 that shows a break. So it looks like it's getting optically thin around millimeter wavelengths. And you know, even at a few milliarc seconds, we're looking at relativistic stuff. So there have been a lot of discussion about how fast jets get moving relativistically and what could do that. That's certainly something that should guide any effort to try to model these sources on very small scales. And lastly, there are some morphological constraints. We do know what direction it's pointing. So those are just the facts I'm going to use today. We've also seen these observations a number of times now. This proto-EHT array in 2009 detected structure on horizon scales in M87. That was reported a couple years ago. And there are a few key differences from Sagittarius Star, despite the fact that the visibilities look maddeningly similar. The first is we don't have to worry about interstellar scattering, we believe. So a lot of that discussion yesterday isn't relevant for this today. And there's very clear evidence for an extended jet, remaining agnostic about the presence of a jet in Sagittarius Star. Certainly in M87 there is one. Key similarities, we have horizon scale structure. When I was recently looking at some of the history of radio observations of M87, I was struck because I saw these pictures in another paper, and here's an example of it. The one I saw it in was from 1954, but here's a nice picture of M87 from a paper in 67, and you can imagine just how far we've come. There's a beautiful image just a couple years ago from LOFAR, and of course we're well on our way towards doing that. That's where we are today, and this is where we hope to be in a few years in M87. So it's nice how history doesn't repeat, but certainly rhymes, and it's certainly the case here. I felt like I was part of the story. And the spin result that comes from even these very early results has been touched upon again multiple times. It really just comes from a statement that if the mass is 6 billion solar masses, that the source is so small that if the jet's going to be launched within a characteristic accretion radius, the ISCO, most stable circular orbit, the spin has to be bigger than a half. Okay, but that actually puts very few constraints on what that jet structure has to be. And we do have people who've worked very hard in trying to work out what kinds of structures jets ought to be described by. And here's one simulation from John McKinney, who spoke earlier today, that shows sort of a canonical picture, I think, of jet structure these days. You have a fast, force-free core surrounded by a wind coming off of a disk. And this is the thing that gets going to those relativistic speeds. Okay, so I think that there's really a consensus now that's forming over what kind of physics you might want to know if you wanted to understand the structure of at least this class of jet launching models. Okay, you need force-free, roughly parabolic material. And there's some evidence that this actually has something to do with reality in the form of the radial structure, the width of M87 as a function of distance from the core. So this is not totally out in left field. It is a little bit complicated, though, and I'm not that smart, so I'm going to use a very simple case, build a simple, almost cartoon model, along the lines of what I think we heard this morning, just assuming force-free. So we have some assumptions about axisymmetry and stationarity, some assumptions about the constitutive relationship, force-free, meaning that the particles adjust their positions instantaneously. And with that and Maxwell's equations, it becomes a graduate-level problem to work out the structure of the magnetic field. Of course, that's subject to boundary conditions, and the place we normally assign them is down near the black hole, and there's two places we do that. We do it first in how fast these magnetic field lines are being pulled around, either being pulled around by frame dragging by the black hole or pulled around by being embedded in an accretion flow. And once you've given those, then you can write down a unique solution for the structure. And the answers you get are not totally ridiculous. Here's a picture from a simulation from John that shows, among other things, a surface of constant Lorentz factor in the jet. It's accelerating fastest along some critical line, some critical field line. And these force-free models produce exactly the same sort of morphological features. You have some contours of Lorentz factor that are fastest along some field lines. And it turns out this comparison isn't just qualitative. Where they do differ is in the assumption of what that angular velocity is. So in some sense, this is the key ingredient. How fast are you dragging magnetic field lines around? In these models, we have a very simple picture. It rises until it gets to the ISCO, and then it turns over. So as the spin changes, it rises to a higher and higher value. Over in magnetically launched jet simulations, typically it turns over a little bit earlier. So when I'm going to give you limits on spin, you can think of those as being a little bit too loose. I probably needed an even higher value to push the angular velocities up high enough. But they're not totally, totally different. So this provides a sort of a cartoon set of pictures to start analyzing those EHT data and see what this more realistic picture gives us. Of course, I'm neglecting something very important. We like to talk about the magnetic field structures of jets all the time, and then we look at these beautiful pictures, and making a connection is complicated by all that stuff we've heard about in the afternoon yesterday and a little bit earlier with Monica's talk. This is all produced by non-thermal particles, which are not being simulated. So we have to paint them in somehow. And on the horizon scales, that makes a huge difference. Okay, two different methods for filling the jet up with non-thermal particles produces, even though the jet structures aren't or shouldn't be totally different in these cases, very, very different pictures. So that's a critical systematic uncertainty that we have to address in trying to produce something that we can compare directly to observations. Now, in the case of M87, I think we lucked out a little bit. There's a key simplifying factor here, and that is within M87, the synchrotron cooling time, as what's shown here in the vertical axis, is actually long in comparison to the outflow time. So we have this blue line sits above this red line. The synchrotron cooling time is long in comparison to the cooling time, and that means that the particles simply can't cool as they're being advected out. Now, that doesn't happen indefinitely. At some point, the synchrotron cooling time gets small enough. It's dropping. The synchrotron cooling time is growing because the magnetic field is dropping, but at some point, the magnetic field doesn't drop fast enough. And the particles do efficiently cool. But that can happen. In fact, it's expected to happen somewhere around 1,000 gravitational radii out, much further out than the typical scales the EHT is probing. And what that means is, below this point, down here where the EHT is seeing things, non-thermal particles, these accelerated particles responsible for producing the synchrotron emission, are effectively conserved. Okay, so that gives me a natural way to start parametrizing them. Okay, so just imagine that somewhere they're injected. Just give me a height at which you're going to inject inside of. And following that, they're just conserved. They're convected outwards. They're advected outward. Okay? So now I have a one-parameter model for filling my jet, for painting my jet with non-thermal particles. So it's a classic trick in physics. You just parametrize your ignorance. And my parameter is where you started to fill your jet. So now we have an idea for a magnetic field structure that's just force-free stationary solutions. We have an idea for how to paint it with particles. There are also a lot of observational constraints. Okay, some of these are connected to fundamental parameters. How fast we're going to pull the field lines around are connected to the spin. where we load it is connected to this uncertain jet loading height. But other things, like an asymptotic Lorentz factor, are fixed by observations. Okay, we have an idea of what the orientation of the jet is. It turns out this is a very easy parameter to let vary, so I'm going to let it vary and see what happens. We know roughly what the shape, the poloidal field line shape of those magnetic fields are. That constrains the force-free solution. Okay, and we also have particle densities to set, magnetic field strengths to set, maybe a spectral index, the distribution of those non-thermal particles. And those are set in part, or in total, by the spectrum. All right? We have a spectral constraint that we have to satisfy. And that's sufficient for every choice of spin and load height to set these. And when you do that, you obtain a library of models. These are slowly changing. Let's look at this one on the left first. This shows what happens as you load the jet further and further out, as particles start appearing in the jet further and further out. Okay, when they appear very close in, you very clearly see the black hole shadow cast against a counterjet. But as they're loaded further and further out, the counterjet becomes dimmer and dimmer, and you see it less prominently. Similarly, over here, we have black hole spin, which is being shown from high to low. So that's low. The flashing is a renormalization of scales. That's high. Okay. So we have a set of models based upon this spectrally fit force-free jet cartoon, which I'd argue is not totally out of left field. It's actually mocking up some of the very important physics. And we can compare that model directly. We can go compute the interferometric observables, go compute visibility magnitudes directly, and compare them, and ask which orientations, which spins, and which load heights fit. And just jumping right to the answer, here's our favorite model. This fits the best. One thing that's very interesting about this model is, contrary to how I normally plot things, with spin going up, because that's how I calculate them, I've rotated appropriately. The spin's off in this direction. Okay, so even though the spin's off in this direction, we see a prominent feature over here. That's just due to the helical motion in the jet. Stuff's going around. We're seeing beaming on one side. It makes it highly asymmetric. But more importantly, remember I said that because it was easy to allow these images to rotate on the sky, we permitted the position angles to change. And that provides an independent sanity check. You know, anybody can make a blobby model and go fit it to the visibilities, but we think these jets are launched along the direction of the spin. And indeed, if I were to look at this much further out, this would all begin to align with the spin. And that means that this spin direction should be aligned with the larger scale jet. Out to milliarc seconds, larger scale for the EHT. All right? And if you look at where the allowed region is, it's exactly in this direction. All right, so we're fitting visibility magnitudes. There are two solutions. I could have flipped the whole thing around, of course. One of those solutions sits right in the direction of the larger scale jet. The spin direction is pointing along the jet, even though the emission is pointing off in some funny direction. So just with the Event Horizon Telescope data alone, you could reconstruct the direction of the larger scale jet. I don't think that proves anything, but it suggests maybe it's, again, not totally crazy. This is not incidental. You know, when we chose one picture, we chose a helicity for the motion. Okay, we chose a direction for where the magnetic field lines were going. You can reflect the image. It's the opposite helicity. And you can go and repeat the analysis. And indeed, you get a similarly constrained region with a totally wrong direction. Okay, so it's not incidental that we were able to get the right direction. The load radius is really an interesting question. It doesn't load right next to the horizon in these models. I think that's telling us something fundamental about what lights these jets up. It wants to light up around 10 gravitational radii. I think the peak's actually at 13. I would say that probably suggests we're not looking at internal shocks. I don't think, but my colleagues who do GRMHD simulations can correct me, there's a whole lot of internal shocks at those radii. I don't think this is coming from the accretion disk, if you think anything that we've done so far makes sense. And I don't think it's really MHD turbulence in the jet, although it could certainly be something around the boundary. Okay. We do have some picture. Stick around. Sasha Chakovskoy will talk a little bit about that. There are mechanisms that might just work for this. The implications for spin. Well, it turns out that if this mocks up magnetically launched, or electromagnetically launched jets at all, we need very high spin. Bigger than 0.96. Just compare that to bigger than 0.5. Okay, that's a sea change of difference. That spin estimate's not correlated with any of the unknown parameters very significantly. So that's actually a pretty robust statement. Now, I mentioned before that we're really parametrizing not by spin, but by how fast we're pulling field lines around. This red line is what we assumed. The key feature in the red line is at zero spin, we still get a jet. All right? And we want to live at angular velocities faster than about this gray bar. If you were to guess the angular velocity of the horizon, so field lines stuck on the horizon and didn't slip, you'd get this blue bar that's a little bit less restrictive. It allows you to get to lower spin. But if you were to assume the angular velocity of the maximum efficiency for Blanford-Nyack, which I think is comparable to what's found in those simulations, that might suggest an even higher spin limit. So I think that we're sort of middle of the road, if not pessimistic, in our spin constraint. A second key issue is, what about the mass? If I change the scale of the image by a factor of 2, surely that's going to make a big difference in the size of the constraints I can place. And in principle, it does, but not by as much as you think, because as you decrease the scale of the image, you have to drive the photosphere out, and those are roughly compensatory effects. Even if you have the low mass model, we're talking about bigger than about 0.9. These can be distinguished not by the data right now, but potentially by data in the future. Closure phases are one example. Here's our favorite high mass model, which is the one I showed before. Here's our favorite low mass model. Morphologically, they do look quite different, and they have correspondingly different closure phases. So if you want to hear about where that's going, stick around for Kazu's talk next. And finally, it's interesting to talk about trying to validate electromagnetically launched jet models. But it turns out that gives us a lot of leverage in other ways. And there are two here. I mean, there's the obvious astrophysical one. It kind of closes the loop here on potentially relating the large-scale feedback to the small-scale features of the black hole. All right, feedback that we heard before, maybe spin is not the knob that dictates this. But if M87 is rapidly spinning and has a powerful jet, at least that's a circumstantial piece of evidence. But there's another way, and that comes into evidence for the existence of event horizons. And let me just spend a couple slides explaining that. So in the current thinking, you cannot have a jet without having a disk. And the reason is, in order to hold the magnetic flux in the region where it can extract energy from the black hole, you need to have the accretion disk pushing it in. You need the pressure from the gas to contain it. And so in principle, you could imagine a situation where the gas sits in a torus, balances exactly against the magnetic field lines, holds the field lines on the black hole, there's no accretion, and yet we extract power. But in practice, when you try to implement that, instabilities arise at this interface, and you always end up having accretion through. You can beat the accretion rate, you can beat the power going in by factors of a few, but not by a whole lot more than that. Okay, so the jet power coming out is related to the accretion rate. It could be more efficient, because we're tapping spin energy from the black hole in this case, but only by a few. And if that were not a black hole, if it were something without an event horizon, if it were, say, a star, for sake of argument, I don't know how you make a 6 billion solar mass star, but something with a photosphere, then that accreting material would heat the star up, develop a boundary layer, would heat up, and you'd start to shine. You'd radiate the rest of the energy contained on the material as it is evected onto the star, and emit some surface luminosity. And this isn't totally crazy. I mean, this is actually seen in accreting neutron stars. And if the surface, if whatever this thing is sufficiently compact, and if you assume it's been doing this for a long time, where a long time is defined in relation to light crossing time of the object, you'd expect this all to be thermal. So we know how much, and we know roughly where to look for it. And like I said, you see this in neutron stars. They're brighter than their comparable black holes in X-ray binaries, presumably because of the surface emission. We can make this argument very well in the case of Sagittarius A star already, flux measurements that fall below where a putative surface would lie. And now, if you believe that electromagnetically launched jets are how M87 works, you can make this argument in M87. Okay, so here's the flux measurements of M87. Here's various jet powers ranging from the most pessimistic estimates to something that's probably way too big. Middle of the road's right here. And you can see this lies above all these data points. And at a bit of dig at our Bicep 2 colleagues, you know, this is a much bigger than 7 sigma result. Of course, there are systematic errors. There are big ifs. If M87 is electromagnetically driven, if it's in steady state, if it's sufficiently compact, if you believe many of the things I said today, then it's true. And it would join Sag A star as only the second example in which this argument can be made in detail, not in a statistical sense. Okay, so here's my summary. I think that it's safe to say now that electromagnetically launched jets are at least presenting a highly successful model for M87. Regardless of the detailed mechanism for what's driving the electromagnetic jets, M87 should have high spin if that story holds any water. And there are critical simplifications that are allowed by the specifics of the system, which allow us to parameterize the very uncertain particle acceleration physics. We do have very different predictions for closure phases for the high and low mass, so that might provide a second way to discriminate between them. And there are good reasons why validating electromagnetically launched jets could affect fundamental physics, providing a good example for existence of event horizons. Thank you very much.
Time for questions, yes.
Probably I'm confused, but if you use the Blanvers-Nyack version of omega, then do you actually have to have a spin that's bigger than one, essentially? I mean, do you have the opposite problem of needing something that violates general relativity, essentially, to get things to work?
You are worried that this curve never hits the gray line.
That's right. So by mini sigma, yeah, any Blanvers-Nyack model, you're actually predicting things are inconsistent.
I think there are other reasons why at high spin.
Yeah, there's probably other systematic stuff.
So I would be really worried. I'm not going to try to make anything out of anywhere up here. Let's leave it that. Bigger than 0.9 is good enough for me. That's where I think I trust them.
And then particularly the Blanvers-Nyack, is that a half of omega?
Half, yeah.
So maybe for paraboloidal, which I think what you want for collimation, that might be more, maybe closer to a quarter. That would even make it smaller.
Yeah. Over there.
I was wondering, because you're an expert on polarization as well, spending a lot of time this in the early days, would you expect to predict some circular polarization? And that would relate it to the helicity of your model, and you could sort of break that degeneracy and check that through conversion, for example.
I have not looked at it at all. I was just focused on looking at the total intensity. It's definitely an excellent question, but I haven't looked at that.
That would be your homework.
That would be my homework. Yeah. We do the full polarized radiative transfer, and that's reasonably important when you have the global magnetic fields. But I just didn't look.